Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org. Hello, and welcome to Nature Now for this first week of November. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and today I'll be talking with Dr. Jill Rowland, Director of the U.S. Geological Survey Western Fisheries Research Center. Jill Rowland will be the feature speaker at this Sunday's Future of the Oceans lecture series, sponsored by the Port Townsend Marine Science Center. But first, before talking to Jill, let's do a couple of other things. Let's hear this week's mystery sound. Sorry about the background noise. The mystery critter makes that high squeaking sound you heard. And we'll be back a bit later in the program to reveal the maker of this mystery sound. For observations and news of the week, I'm taking a little creative license with the observations to share with you. It didn't actually occur in or around the Olympic Peninsula, but it could have. Rather, the observers were two folks from Port Townsend, Monica Fletcher, birder extraordinaire, and her husband, Steve Evans, producer of KPTZ's Compass program. Their car broke down near Ellensburg in late September, and that led to a great discovery for Monica and Steve. As they walked from the repair shop along Main Street right around dusk, a few Vox swifts, high-flying aerial birds that looked like cigars with sickle-shaped wings, showed up. And then there were 15, and then 50, then 200, then 1,000, then countless. I actually saw the video they made of this event. The birds swirled around in a huge circle, chattering fiercely. Then they began to fall silent and plummet into an unused chimney of a furniture store. It looked like the chimney was vacuuming up the birds. This was not only a great spectacle for anyone to see, it also turned out to be an unknown, unreported, significant roost on the southern migration of these birds from British Columbia to Mexico. Monica and Steve reported it to the Kittitas County Audubon Society, who were really grateful to find out the whereabouts of their local Vox swifts, because a hospital chimney had been demolished 5 years ago, and the migrating birds had lost their roost. Reporting their findings to a group called Vox Happening, Monica and Steve's discovery became listed in the 2017 annual report for the whole Pacific Flyway. Port Angeles's roost reported 40 birds, but the Ellensburg Furniture Store roost recorded 1,500. Statewide, this is good news, over 246,000 Vox swift were recorded by volunteers this year from across the state. And I have just one more thing in the observation and news category, and that's the Puget Sound Partnership recently released its biannual report, 2017 State of the Sound. To quote Janine Boir, the executive director of the Port Townsend Marine Science Center, it is part report card, part inspiring successes, and, not surprising to many of us, a wake-up call that much more work is needed, requiring many more resources, and will take much longer than those 3 additional years originally envisioned. The report is available online by Googling Puget Sound Partnership 2017 report. So in that theme, I think we all know that for decades, scientists and concerned citizens have called for improving salmon spawning and rearing habitats in an attempt to reverse the trend of dwindling runs of salmon and steelhead in Puget Sound. Most of us are aware of the toll that habitat degradation and destruction do to human activities such as logging, road building, construction of hydroelectric dams, and urban development has had on our once abundant salmon populations. And for decades, habitat restoration has focused on restoring the many streams and rivers throughout the Northwest. Today, I'm talking with Dr. Jill Rowland. She's the director of the U.S. Geological Survey Western Fisheries Research Center in Seattle. We'll be talking about salmon and the science surrounding the salmon restoration and the challenges that are posed here in Puget Sound. Jill has a bachelor's degree in fisheries from the University of Washington and a master's and doctoral degrees in fish health from the University of Bergen in Norway. So welcome, Jill.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with a little kind of basic background. Can you briefly summarize for us the recovery status of salmon and steelhead in the Salish Sea?
Well, unfortunately, the news there is not really great news. I think steelhead, we've seen a decline over the last 100 years. Once upon a time, they were in the 325,000 and sometimes 800,000 range. And today, we think we have around 13,000. And when we think about Chinook salmon in particular, there's only 22 of the 37 historic populations. And the Puget Sound Partnership has been working to bring together many state, tribal, and federal agencies, including ours, looking at the recovery of Puget Sound and indicator species such as orcas and Chinook and steelhead. And they recently came out with their 2017 report, and unfortunately, the news isn't really, really great. Although we've had some success in some of the indicators, in general, the populations are not recovering as they had hoped, and certainly having recovery in 2020 is not a goal that's going to be attainable.
So I think most of us are aware that there's been a lot of habitat restoration in our streams and rivers. Can you talk a bit about how effective that's been?
So we have some examples of restoration, including the Nisqually and the Elwha. And while it might be too soon to say how effective the Nisqually restoration has been, we've seen the physical restoration and the plants coming back. Scientists are still trying to understand how juvenile salmon and steelhead are using that environment, and certainly we're not sure that they're using it as effectively as they might. But at the same time, it's recent. These things take time, and even though we're able to get the environment back to where we want it, fish still have to become accustomed to using this environment that has recently opened up for them. In contrast, I think the Elwha is a great example of where we have evidence that not only are fish using that nearshore environment, we've seen all the historic salmon runs establishing themselves, reestablishing themselves above where those dams used to be located.
That's really exciting for us to see out here, too.
Exactly. Of course, they have the advantage of having the majority of the river in a national park, so that habitat upstream is really pristine.
It's pretty fine,
and that helps.
Yes. Before we go much further, I have to ask, I thought I knew what the U.S. Geological Survey did, but I was a little surprised that they're doing fisheries research. Why is that?
There's a long history to that, and I'll just get to the point, and that is that during the Clinton administration, there was a move to take all of the science functions out of various interior departments, including the Park Service and Fish and Wildlife Service, and those were all moved into the U.S. Geological Survey with the idea that that would be the one-stop shop for all science needs within the Department of Interior. So the history of my lab is that it once belonged to the Fish and Wildlife Service. Many of us are now in the U.S. Geological Survey, so we're not just earthquakes and geology.
Well, thank you, because I was a little surprised, but now it's beginning to make much more sense. Let's now go on to find out from you what scientists have been learning about risks and impacts on salmon and steelhead from things other than from the traditional habitat destruction or change, those things we've been thinking about for a long time. What else is going on in terms of impacts on the salmon? I'm thinking water quality, diseases, pathogens, etc. Maybe start with the question of diseases.
I'd like to start out by saying I think intuitively we understand that you can't just fix one thing, that nature is inherently complex and that there are lots of interactions. And so although habitat is important and having that habitat available is very important, there are other things that are going on. And this is a growing area. We have a huge increase in the population, and that's likely to just continue to increase. And so we're trying to figure out how we're going to share this.
So you're talking about the human population increase.
Yes, the human population, correct. And so some of the things that we're starting to explore are things like diseases. And there are many diseases that are present in the aquatic environment that are ubiquitous and naturally occurring and perhaps historically haven't had much impact. But as there are other stresses on fish, whether it be water quality or temperature, one pathogen that we've been working on is called nanophytis, and it is a trematode parasite, and it's been in Puget Sound for as long as we know of. And although it doesn't kill fish, we're starting to learn that in steelhead in particular, fish are coming out of the rivers with a really heavy burden of this parasite.
Hmm.
And so even though it doesn't kill them outright, it might be slowing down their swimming efficiency and making it easier for predators to catch them, which might be having a bigger impact on steelhead's ability to recover than what we previously may have thought.
So do scientists know why that parasite load is increasing in the fish?
Well, that's one of the things that we're looking at. And one environmental factor is stream temperature. And in areas such as the Green River, we know that stream temperatures have gone up. And that seems to be at least one of the factors that is increasing the parasite load, although that's rather simplistic. There are other things involved.
Mm-hmm. Several months ago, I did an interview on sort of the state of the sea star wasting disease. At the time, one of the thoughts seemed to be they had shown that it was caused by a particular virus that has been part of the marine environment probably longer than we've been around.
Right.
But the scientists at the time were then speculating anyway that perhaps it was the stresses from temperature and other environmental changes on the starfish that made that disease so much more devastating to the populations. Are we likely to see the same kind of thing going on in fish populations?
I think so, and we have examples of that from the Yukon River up in Alaska, where the stream temperatures there have really increased incredibly in an environment which is, you think of as being very cold.
Very clean, yeah.
Right, and we see similar issues there with some other fish diseases where the salmon are not getting back to their spawning grounds because they are so loaded with some diseases and the water temperature is so high that it's really exacerbating those disease problems. We also saw it in 2015 in the Columbia River. That was the year of the drought. I'm sure lots of folks can remember that hot, dry summer. And we were seeing fish diverting from their path to their native streams, trying to find cold water refugia, and they were covered in fungus. And I think most people who see salmon return to spawn realize that these fish are under stress and that they do get these fungal infections, but many of these fish just never made it back to their native streams because the loads from that fungus was so heavy that they were dying long before they made it anywhere close to their native rivers.
Wow.
Yeah.
Talk to me a bit about issues around water quality and pollution from various contaminants. What's the latest on that subject?
Well, I think we have a history of showing some impacts, especially from estrogen-like compounds that are commonly found in birth control pills. And there's a lot of scientific literature about how these compounds can have some immediate effects, especially on juvenile fish, where fish might be displaying both female and male sexual characteristics, and of course this has a short-term impact on these fish's ability to reproduce.
Indeed.
But we're also starting to see that there can be some long-term impacts, and that's one of the things that we've been studying here at this laboratory. We're seeing that there can be actual impacts to fish, the fish immune system, and that not only can these compounds reduce the immune system's ability to ward off disease, but that these changes might be heritable, meaning they're passed on to the next generation. And so the long-term implications of that could be not too favorable.
Wow, the notion that it might be heritable is stunning. Let's try another subject. How about sound or light pollution?
Yeah, so this is also a relatively new area of research that USGS is involved in. So interestingly, we have found that light pollution might be having more of an impact than we thought previously. And I think if you look at satellite images of major metropolitan areas, you're used to seeing these bright spots, including around Seattle and Puget Sound. And if you think about fish behavior, historically, the primary time where you had predatory fish out looking for food is in those kind of twilight hours or right at dawn or dusk. And what we're learning is that with all this light coming from streetlights and homes, we've been taking measurements and seeing that that light penetration actually goes quite a bit down. And so when these fish that might be predated on might have had a safe time to rest and find food themselves, that used to be when it was pitch black. But now that period of time is essentially gone in many parts of Puget Sound. So that, too, might be having large implications. I think the good news about that is that there are types of light bulbs that can provide lighting on streets that don't penetrate the water column. And so at least this is one of those problems that perhaps is a little more tangible, a little more easily solved. It takes money, but it's at least something that is something that we can deal with quite a bit more easily.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking of all those satellite photos you see of the swaths of bright lights on the coastal and metropolitan areas. Hadn't really thought about the impact on fish or the impact on the prey species of the salmon. That's really interesting. Give listeners a little tickler or teaser about your lecture that's coming up with the Marine Science Center this coming Sunday.
Okay. So I do plan on going a little bit more in depth on some of this research that we've been doing in these less studied or newly emerging areas of science that are impacting recovery. And I think that there is some good news, and that is I think we've learned from the ELWA and other areas that one thing we can be certain about is that nature is resilient. Allowing nature to take its course and to restore itself, I think the ELWA has been a great example of showing that if we can help move things along for nature to recover its own areas, that it will do so. And it might take time, and I do think that there is a will, especially in the Puget Sound. I think we really associate ourselves here in the Puget Sound area with nature and our iconic species. And so we'll be talking about that recovery and helping nature do its job so that we can all try and live together in this dynamic area.
So that does sort of give a little bit of hope to what was sounding pretty discouraging. And I'm going to ask you, I know it's tough and I know it's hard to even phrase, what can science tell us about the future of the salmon in the Sound?
I think that we do see that nature is resilient, and certainly we do need to be putting resources towards those efforts that really make a difference. And I think that's where science is extremely important. There are times when intuitively you think that perhaps one approach might be the one thing we need to do to help salmon recovery or steelhead recovery, but we've learned that it's really complex and we need to understand where to make our investments wisely, because we don't have an endless pot of money to put towards salmon restoration. And so we want science to guide us to make smart decisions, kind of get the most bang for your buck in terms of recovery, and that's where science can help lead the way.
Well, that's a great end to our short interview, and I'm sure we're all really quite looking forward to your talk this coming Sunday. That's at Fort Worden, and it's sponsored by the Port Townsend Marine Science Center. So thanks so much, Jill.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, that was fascinating. And I hope your curiosity has been enlivened by some of the things that Jill shared with us. Well, let's hear that mystery sound. That was the piping of the Vox Swift, a true bird of the Pacific Northwest. The Vox Swift spends almost all of the daylight hours in the air foraging for insects. It's very similar to the chimney swift, the common species of the eastern United States, in appearance and habits. The Vox Swift is the smallest swift in North America. They roost communally, as we heard from Monica Fletcher and Steve Evans's observations. Presumably, that roosting is to conserve heat. They let their body temperature drop and become torpid on cold nights, reviving in the warmth of the day. They descend into the roost tree or chimney essentially all at once, spiraling down a very dramatic rush right at nightfall. Vox Swift was named for William S. Vox. He was a member of the Academy of Natural Sciences and a friend of John K. Townsend, who first described this species. By the way, John Townsend is not connected to the friend of Captain George Vancouver, the Marquis of Townsend, for whom our bay and eventually the town was named. Now, looking forward to what's coming up, and with the help of Charlie Flashman, our stalwart sound engineer, we'll look for events for the next couple of weeks.
Every Wednesday morning at 8:30 a.m., meet at the Dungeness River Audubon Center for a bird walk to see and hear the birds of the Dungeness Riparian Forest. Information gathered during these regular walks helps the Audubon Society understand the annual cycle of birds in Railroad Bridge Park. All ages and experience levels are welcome to attend. It is good birding and good company.
And the Native Plant Society hosts a hike along the Lower Big Quilcene Trail on Saturday, November the 11th. The Lower Big Quilcene Trail starts at about 1,200 feet, and it's a fairly gentle, low-elevation hike to Bark Shanty Camp. The intention of this hike is to get out in the lower mountains and walk. It's a little wetter than other areas on the eastern side of the Olympics.
And of course, from the guest of today's program, Jill Rowland, you can learn more on Sunday, November 12th, at the Future of the Oceans lecture series sponsored by the Port Townsend Marine Science Center.
Slightly further afield, on Tuesday, November 14th, the Sea Doc Society, which is located on Orcas Island, is hosting a lecture by Dr. Drew Harvell of Cornell University titled Sea Star Wasting Disease. What is happening now?
Get ready for the November-December meeting of the Natural History Society Book Club. Start your reading of Shadows of Our Ancestors by Jerry Gorslein. The Natural History Society Book Club will meet on December 4th and is open to all.
So that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas. Email us at naturenow@kptz.org. Nature Now airs at 12:05 p.m. on Wednesdays, with repeats here on KPTZ, that's 91.9 FM, on Thursdays at 5:05 p.m. and Saturdays at 12:30 a.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website. Thanks for listening.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Closing music is It's Your World, performed by Leftover Salmon.
Oh, well, those cars that they've been dealing. Just turn and walk away. You're not the first to make mistakes. But don't wait till it's too late. It's not too late. It's your world. Don't let them rearrange it. It's your world. You might as well just face it. Don't you let them change it. They may never really understand those emotions you've been through, but you can't live by someone else's plan who's never walked inside your shoes. Your world.